Welcome to The Cost of Culture. This is a podcast for anyone curious about the hidden world behind the glamour of book collecting, and for anyone wanting to know a little more about history and about the Middle Ages. I'm Elizabeth Dernley, and I'll be your host as we look at a different aspect of book collecting each episode with researchers from the Cultivate Manuscripts Project at the University of London. Join us as we explore how a small group of people working in the rare books trade in the early 20th century affected the way we think about the value of European culture today. Welcome to today's episode. So today we'll be focusing on the role of women in the trade of medieval manuscripts. And with us today to talk about this is Natalia Fantetti, one of the PhD students working on the Cultivate project. So hi, Natalia.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the podcast. So could you start by telling us a bit about your PhD project?
Well, in a nutshell, I'm looking at the different ways that women were involved in the medieval manuscript trade and trying to bring their stories to light. A lot of what has been written about the trade has focused on the men. And so what we're getting as a result is a very skewed narrative of what actually went on. In truth, there were female collectors, librarians, cataloguers, scholars, book dealers. Basically, there were women occupying all of the same roles that men did, just to a lesser extent.
So today you're going to be talking to us about three of these women in particular that you've been working on, who embody different aspects of women's involvement in the manuscript trade. So we have Belle da Costa Green, the librarian of J.P. Morgan that we discussed in the last episode, the collector Isabella Stewart Gardner, and finally Anne Nill, who worked in the trade for and with the famous book dealer Wilfred Voynich. So of the three of these women, the one who's received some more attention recently is Belle da Costa Green. Could you say a bit about why her place in this history is so important?
I'd say Belle Green is arguably the most famous woman involved with the medieval manuscript trade in the first half of the 20th century, and probably the most visible at the time. As personal librarian to J.P. Morgan, and later as the first director of the Morgan Library, a position she held for 25 years, Belle occupied an unusually powerful position for a woman at that time. And alongside her work at the Morgan, she also sat on the committees of various museums, like the Walters Art Gallery, was a rare book and art collector in her own right, and was a founding member of the Froswitha Club, the first rare book club for women. And additionally, though she did not make it public knowledge, Green was also a woman of colour and the daughter of a prominent African-American rights activist, making her place in the upper echelons of society and in the trade even more uncommon. I think it's actually quite telling that the exhibition that the Morgan Library is putting on in 2024 to celebrate the centenary of being a public institution is dedicated to Green, not to Morgan Senior or Junior.
That's really interesting. So she's getting this attention now. What other sorts of things have been written about her recently, or other types of attention that's been drawn to her?
Well, there has been a couple of books published in the last couple of years that have been fictionalizations, novelizations of her life, both in French and in English. And so what I think we're seeing is someone whose life story kind of lends itself to that kind of narrative and sort of a story arc in itself, because she led a very interesting life. And at least it seems that these days she's getting some kind of attention within creative spheres as well as scholarly ones.
And if any of the people listening to this came along to the Being Human play that we wrote for the festival last year, that was a dramatization of an auction, but one of the characters portrayed was Belle Green. And actually the actor and actress, the actress who played Belle Green, is really keen to do more work developing the character as well. So as you say, she's really somebody who captures people's imaginations.
Mm.
So thinking about the historical Belle Green, how did she impact the involvement of other women in the trade? You know, did she seek to promote other women in the workplace or create opportunities for other women?
whilst clearly a trailblazing woman, and there's no doubt about that, her attitude towards feminism changed across time. At one point, she joined the Anti-Suffrage League, and at another, she attended meetings of the Lucy Stone League, which encouraged women to keep their names after marriage. I would call her something of a reluctant proto-feminist, if I was to summarise it. But what can't be denied is that under her direction, the Morgan Library took on a staff that was over 50% women, and though she may not have readily admitted it, she did mentor and nurture female manuscript scholars such as Meta Harson and Dorothy Minor.
So clearly she was incredibly knowledgeable about medieval manuscripts. Did she produce any scholarship herself?
I guess it depends on how we define scholarship. If we're talking strictly about published articles and monographs, then no, she did not produce any scholarship. But I think that's quite a narrow view of things. She did write up catalogues of the Morgan collection and left copious notes behind that are used by the Morgan Library staff today. So it's not traditional scholarship, but I think she's definitely still a scholar.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess this question of, you know, what is and what isn't traditional scholarship is itself quite a contentious question. Like, what do we include as part of scholarship and what do we not? What's extraneous? So moving on to thinking about collectors of manuscripts, let's talk a bit now about Isabella Stewart Gardiner, who's the second woman that we're discussing today. We talked before on the podcast about very well-known figures like J.P. Morgan. So would you say that Gardiner has a similar kind of status?
Isabella Stewart Gardiner was one of the great American art collectors of her age. And unlike Morgan, she actually wrote the first catalogue of her books herself. Though doubtless a wealthy woman, with money both from her own inheritance and later from her husband, she was armed with less disposable income than her contemporaries like Morgan and Henry Huntington. But Gardiner had a keen eye and a top-notch team of experts that she actually listened to, which allowed her to assemble a museum-worthy collection of paintings, sculptures, furniture, and, yes, medieval manuscripts.
So, sounds like she collected so many different things. How did her manuscript collection relate to these wider collecting interests? And what sort of manuscripts did she collect?
Well, her manuscript collection represents a smaller part of her acquisitions, so has often been overlooked by scholars in favour of concentrating on her paintings. Gardiner's somewhat eccentric and unconventional personality has also contributed to her being perceived as a less serious collector, whatever that means. But what a lot of people don't know is that Gardiner was also an enthusiastic reader of Dante, to the extent that of auditing a class at Harvard and accumulating rare copies and manuscripts of the author's works. And as well as the Dante manuscripts, she also collected various other Italian manuscripts. She was definitely a big Italophile.
Yeah, that's also really interesting, kind of loaded term, isn't it? This idea of being a serious collector. As you say, what does that even mean? Does it mean people who collect a certain type of material or people who are more systematic about it in some way? Yeah, again, it's a really subjective way of thinking about things. So where are all of Isabella Stewart Gardiner's manuscripts today?
Gardiner's manuscripts, along with the rest of her collection, are housed in the museum that she founded. The Isabella Stewart Gardiner Museum in Boston came about from her singular vision to create a space for art and culture for the public. And so visitors will be able to see the majority of the manuscripts in a cabinet in the museum's long room, exactly where Gardiner placed them. The choicest manuscripts are also in the process of being digitized.
So we'll add links in the show notes to the museum as well. Let's move on now to the third woman we're talking about today, Anne Nill. So she was an example of a woman involved in dealing manuscripts during this period.
Bookseller, assistant, secretary, cataloguer, Anne Nill was all of these things. By 1918, she was working for Wilfred Michael Voynich, arguably one of the most famous, though not always most successful, book dealers of the early 20th century. His main offices were in London and New York, where Nill was based. As Voynich's health failed in the late 1920s, she increasingly took hold of the business, writing up catalogue descriptions, keeping up with correspondence, and liaising with his London office. After his death in 1930, Anne kept the business afloat, not only selling from stock, but acquiring new books to sell. She also moved in with Ethel Voynich, Wilfred's wife, to whom she was a kind of assistant come companion.
Ethel Voynich, I suppose, as well, is another really interesting figure that we could talk about at a later point.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, she was a writer and a novelist in her own right, but also sold a few manuscripts and helped with cataloguing as well. So, yes, another very interesting lady.
So Anne played an essential role in maintaining the business. Could you talk a bit about the kind of evidence you've used to trace her influence and impact?
With Neil, it was initially a little hard to pin her down. She's not really mentioned by later scholars, and autobiographies of those who knew her and Voynich mostly refer to her in passing. One of the first things I did when I started researching her was to create a biographical timeline for her. And here, genealogical research, things like ship manifests, birth registration and passport applications, they were quite helpful. To get to grips with her work, it was necessary to turn to the archives and look at that raw material. We're lucky that there's a good chunk of correspondence at the Grolier Club in New York and some things at Yale too. As is often the case with looking at women's histories, things are forgotten rather than lost, and so you need to do a bit more digging.
So people know the name Voynich today. It's usually synonymous with a famous early 15th century manuscript. Did Anne Neil have a role to play in the contemporary history of that manuscript?
Oh, absolutely. The Voynich manuscript is an illustrated codex with an as yet undeciphered writing system. And as such, it's also the subject of various hypotheses and conspiracies surrounding its origins. It became known as the Voynich manuscript as he was the one who bought it in 1912 and brought it into the public consciousness through various exhibitions. He left it to his wife Ethel, and her and Anne continued to stoke scholarly interest in the manuscript in a bid to find a potential buyer for it. It remained unsold at Ethel's death, and so Anne inherited it. Now, Anne had worked for the book dealer H.P. Krauss for at least 10 years in her later life, and it was to Krauss that she eventually sold the Voynich manuscript, though she died the same year.
And the Voynich manuscript, again, is something that we might do an episode on in the future. Such a fascinating and quite mysterious manuscript. You were saying it has this undeciphered writing system. We don't really know what it says, am I right?
Yeah, many people have tried to crack the code, so to speak. And in fact, code breakers have worked in the past to try and decipher it. It's not just manuscript scholars. And so far, nobody has figured out what it means, what it says. So there's still a lot of work to do there.
Yeah, it's completely fascinating. And again, we'll add some images and links to it online in the show notes so you can have a look at it if it's not something you've come across before. But yeah, really, really fascinating artifact. So in the examples that you've given of Anne Neil and also Belle DaCosta Green, the work that they're doing, to a different extent, really lies behind the scenes. So with the Morgan Library, we've got a man's name on the door. With the Voynich manuscript, it's associated with Wilfred Voynich. So could you say a little more about the unseen nature of women's work and the dynamics between these women and the men they worked with, men they worked for?
I think the fact that a good deal of the work that women did was either behind the scenes or not exactly publicised is a big contributing factor as to why their stories have been forgotten. In the case of Green, there's been a lot of debate as to the extent that she was driving Morgan Sr.'s collecting. After all, he was collecting manuscripts and rare books before hiring her. But I'd say she really starts professionalising his buying habits and corralling his existing collection into order. With Neil, she is very much overshadowed by the looming legacy of Voynich. I think in part because of her label as his assistant. It's not an adequate term to describe what she did for the company, but it's often how she's remembered, if she is indeed remembered at all.
Yeah, as you say, it's such a limiting way of talking about what she actually did. I mean, I don't know how analogous this is, but it's really making me think about auteur theory in filmmaking, where often you have like a male director's name, and that's the one that people know, but actually a film isn't made by just one person, it's a whole team of people.
Oh, definitely. It's the woman that's in the cutting room, in the editing suite, the manuscript alternative.
Yeah, I was listening to a great podcast about Peter Bogdanovich and his wife Polly Platt, and it was called The Invisible Woman. And it's, again, making me think of this, that she was the art director and, you know, she was as responsible for the films as he was, but, you know, it's his name that is the one that's known, so. Yeah. So thinking more broadly, do you think it's possible to talk about female collecting or gendered collecting?
In all honesty, I think it's quite hard to put a case forward for gendered collecting. A lot of the ideas surrounding what is considered more masculine or feminine collecting come from historic preconceptions. Let's not forget that just as Gardner collected antique furniture, so did J.P. Morgan. He also had an extensive collection of porcelains. And yet they both collected books and manuscripts, historically thought of as the preserve of men. When you look at the entirety of what people collected, I think assigning a gender to their acquisitive tendencies often becomes a moot point.
Right, so it's more really the narrative that's put on these things is maybe gendered, but not the actual objects.
I don't think so. I don't think you can say porcelains are a woman's collecting item or books are a man's collecting item. I think it's more of what we have put together historically, societally, as what is typically more masculine or feminine, and the narratives that come with that.
Yeah, that makes sense. To what extent do you think these women considered their legacy?
It varies. I'm not sure that Nil considered her legacy, but then again, she is the most behind the scenes of the women we've discussed. And from what I've read, she appears to be the shy and retiring type. Gardner, on the other hand, was 100% concerned with her legacy. You don't stipulate in your will that nothing is to be changed from your museum after your death if how you're perceived post-mortem doesn't matter to you. Green is perhaps the most intriguing of the three, though. She leaves the majority of her art and book collection and savings to the Morgan Library in her will. Her life was dedicated to the library, and so I suppose, in a way, she wanted her legacy to reflect that.
What have been the major challenges you've faced in writing the history of women in the manuscript trade?
I think the main challenge lies in the fact that the resources for writing women's history are far less obvious and visible. Whilst we're now challenging the narrative of great white men in all kinds of areas, this is the narrative that has persisted for so long, and our stores of knowledge have been shaped accordingly. Whether that is in terms of canonical texts that we'll read in a university course, or how archives have been organized and categorized. The fact remains that you've got a better chance of finding a woman in the archives under her husband's, father's, or even her employer's name than her own. But I believe that there are many people from different fields actively trying to combat this phenomenon. Because it's not about rewriting history for the sake of it or to match up with our own more liberal, progressive ideals, but to more accurately capture what actually happened.
So we're coming to the end of this episode now, and I'm going to ask Natalia the question we've been asking all the guests. If you had all the resources of Belle de Costa Green, Isabella Stewart Gardner, and Anne Nil at your disposal, and could own any medieval manuscript, which one would it be and why?
It's an incredibly difficult question. And though the manuscripts at the Morgan and Gardner Museums are of course wonderful, I'd have to pick the Lindisfarne Gospels purely for sentimental reasons. The Gospels are a richly decorated 8th century manuscript, which combines all kinds of wonderful elements from Anglo-Saxon, Celtic and Mediterranean art, as well as being the oldest example of the Gospels in English. I wrote about them for my bachelor's thesis, so I suppose they were the hook that got me particularly interested in medieval manuscripts.
Well, that's a fantastic choice, and wanting them for sentimental reasons, I think, is as good a reason as any. So I'll add a link to the Lindisfarne Gospels as well in the show notes, so you can have a look at them if it's not something you're familiar with, and you can see just how beautiful they are and why I think this is an excellent choice. Okay, well, that's all we have for this episode. So thanks so much, Natalia, for joining us, and catch us next time on The Cost of Culture.